and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest. It is Lloyd Schwartz, who has written a new book on the Brady Bunch called Brady, Brady, Brady. And it is just out from Running Press in all of your bookstores with a foreword, no less, by Monty Hall. That's interesting. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing great, David. How are you doing?
I am fine. It's really a pleasure to talk to you. I've been looking forward to doing this for over a month now, so this is exciting for me. I'm a TV nut, I must admit.
Well, let me interrupt right at the beginning, because it wasn't written by me. It was written by Sherwood and me.
And you. Sherwood Schwartz and you. I'm sorry. I should have said that. Right. Well, you wrote half the book, and he wrote half the book.
That's it. I think that's one of the first books written like that.
Yeah, it's very interesting to read that. I mean, when they show you in the book where your father left off and where you picked up, but it's fascinating to see it from both your sides of what it was like to go through.
Right. We didn't really control each other's writing, and it wasn't until we both read the book that we found out some of the things we didn't know about what each other was thinking.
Right. I love that, and this is just filled with pictures too. Very, very interesting, and some pictures we've never seen before.
Right, and most of those were taken by Mike Lookinland. He played Bobby Brady in the show. His mother would sneak around with a camera, and then years toward the end of it, I guess she just gave us a scrapbook, and the pictures were in there, and we had the scrapbook, and we hadn't been thinking of writing a book, and then we realized how good they were, and how nobody had ever seen any of those. So we talked to her, and she was very proud to have her pictures in the book.
Yes, and there's two sets of pictures here, and one of them, you're in the first one of the second set here, which is interesting. We all knew Sherwood Schwartz was the producer of the show, but I didn't realize until I read this book how big of a hand you had in the show too.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying I wrote the book to say how much I had been doing. But so many books were written by people who hadn't talked to me or hadn't just watched the episodes, and they came to their own conclusions, that when Dad and I got together, we said, let's clear some things up and tell some of the truth that people didn't know. And it became kind of my view of it. Sherwood, Dad was always up in his office, and I was on the set and took care of that, and that's the kind of stuff that people were most interested in.
How is your dad doing, by the way?
He's great. He's 93.
Wow.
And got all of his marbles, and as you can tell by reading the book, we are actually going to produce a big Gilligan feature coming up at Warner Brothers, and he is one of the producers with me, and he's still very active and has opinions, and a great guy, and we get along great.
That is terrific. I mean, the love that you have for your father comes through in the book. I mean, you know, because every time there was a crisis, you both worked together and made it better. And it never seemed to be any blow-ups between the two of you.
You know, I'm going to tell you something, and it's something I should have put in the book. That's one of the problems when you write a book, and then you, I'm mostly coming from television and theater where I always could make changes, and then there's this book, and it exists as it is, and I can't change it. But one of the things I think is really interesting is that when Dad and I worked together, he never knew where I lived. I lived 10 minutes away from him. And that sounds kind of bizarre, but the deal was I was on the set all the time, 6:30 to like 8:30 at night. And then on the weekends, my parents are my parents, so I'm around them. And I really needed a place where he just wasn't. And it's not like I was hiding from him. We discussed it. I said, Dad, I think in order for this to work, I have to have my own world somewhere that you're not part of.
How interesting.
Yeah. Don't you think I should have put that in the book?
Oh, yeah. That's very... I mean, and he didn't even have your address.
No.
So
he dropped me off one side. One time he dropped me off across the street. But that was it, when I needed a ride home. It wasn't like... I wasn't like sneaking around. It just made it very clear. I had to have this other world.
So any time you got a Christmas card, they sent it to the studio, I guess, right?
I was around. I was up at the house, at their house.
Well, how did you work so many long hours and not go crazy?
I love it.
I mean, you were that addicted to doing it. I mean, it was that much fun for you to do.
There was no separation in my life between, anybody who knows me, I never know what day it is, because the day is all just, I mean, if on the weekend I'm going to a movie, that's work, isn't it? But I guess it isn't, but I guess it's fun. And then doing a show, it's work and it's fun. And now I do theater and stuff on the. I've always done that on the weekends, and so that's fun. And so it's just all fun.
But even so, being on that set for that long a period of time, didn't you ever get to the point where you just had to get out of there?
No. Well, I'll tell you one thing. I would hyperventilate intentionally because I would go home and write. I had to write my own things. And at that time, I was working on a project that eventually we did as a play, which was I'm a history student of John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln assassination. And so I would go home and write. And it would be, again, it would be my own thing. Because in order to do Brady Bunch, I also said to Dad, I have to do my own projects as well. I said, no one's going to work harder than me all the time whenever you need me. But I always need to be doing these other things.
Right. Now, there were how many shows?
The original series had 117 episodes.
117, which it's interesting because some of the syndicated shows don't show every episode. Every episode of the Brady Bunch is so well known that they couldn't possibly take one out of syndication because somebody would be upset somewhere.
I think there was one time when we weren't allowed to rerun one episode because it was one about the doctors, and the AMA was upset. I don't know why. There were two doctors for the two kids. I don't something like that. But I think that's gone now. Any kind of objection to it, so I think you'll still see them.
What amazes me the most reading this book is realizing that all the kids were pretty much easy to get along with.
Yeah, yeah.
There weren't any difficult. None of them were difficult.
No, not during the show. Since then, like Eve has kind of tried to distance herself from the show, but not during the filming at all. Because they were one of the things was, and I'll take a little bit of credit, but not all the credit, is that they were children, and we always wanted to keep them children. And because there were six of them, they had a shared journey. Whereas on so many shows, a one child will be on a totally an adult world. So I created for them. I was a summer camp counselor. And it was all like arts and crafts for us. And we had games and things. And we had awards for the child who got all the lines right. Kiddingly, it was all fun.
Well, how do you get kids to memorize lines? That must have been difficult at times.
No, that wasn't because... Because there were six of them, it was not like one kid was like the center of the show all the time.
Right.
Each week, and this is something your listeners were not aware, and the viewers were not aware, we would do a show, we would never feature a child back to back. I mean, one child would have a show, and then they would be featured in another show six shows later, and it became like, oh, this is my episode, and they were excited about that. So there was not a preponderance of work. And then the other ones were in the show all the time, but they didn't have that many lines, and then the parents had lines, so it wasn't an over taxing burden at all.
And I didn't know before in the slumber party episode that Robert Reed's daughter was in it, and actually there were other daughters that were in it.
Lawrence's daughter was in it, and my father's daughter was in it, and actually I just learned recently, and I don't even think it's in the book, is that Christine Baranski. I think had her first job, and she was one of those girls in that hip.
Are you serious? Really?
Yeah. You have to go look at that. I didn't know it. I went and looked at it. Or like also Tom Hanks' wife, Rita
Wilson. Yes.
She had her start there in the Brady Bunch.
I want to watch that episode again just to see all the kids. I mean, and that's
I don't know if she was in that one, but Rita was in a different one. But I know Christine Baranski is. You can spot her.
What is it about the Brady Bunch that has made it so much a part of our lives, so unforgettable? I mean, it's not a show anybody's ever going to forget. What do you think has made it that way?
Well, I think it's a combination of reasons. One, it was one of the first family shows that was done in color, so it doesn't seem that dated. It was a show about a blended family that hadn't been seen before. Also, it was one of the first shows that was family shows that was told from the point of view of the children. Most others, the Donna Reed show or Father Knows Best, if you think about it, they were told from the point of view of how these kids affected, you know, or them affected the parents.
Even Leave It to Beaver was sort of that way, too.
Leave It to Beaver. My favorite shows were Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best. I had this crush on Jane Wyatt. I don't know why as a kid, but I did. She was kind of... Anyway, but when we did Brady Bunch, and because we were never a very high rating during its original run, and we were always in one building, we had the whole set in there, I didn't know that we were having any effect on anyone. So we were just doing a show. It never, in my opinion, compared to those other shows. And then later on, I felt that it had especially when it went to syndication, it had this enormous impact. And now everybody, as you're saying, they seem to know every episode.
Right, absolutely. And now Dancing with the Stars is going to have Florence Henderson next week, too. So it's
Oh, yeah. There's a section in there about me dancing with Florence. You probably read that. But
yes, I read everything in the book. I read it from cover to cover. I mean, it kept me going last night. I mean, just I couldn't stop reading it. It's just one of those books where you, oh, I gotta see what's going to happen next. And now they're into the third season, and what's going to happen here, and what's going to, you know, and you really find yourself looking in on the show being made, and it's quite interesting.
I'm glad. I mean, it's interesting to me, but everybody's life is interesting to them. And I've had a great, I'm not that old, but I've had a great life. I don't regret, resent, repent, or anything.
How often do you talk to the cast members?
With some regularity. There's always something, you know, some talk show, some interview, something. I talk to Ann a lot, Ann B. Davis.
How's she doing?
She's great. She's in, she's eight, she's gonna, I'm giving her age. She's going to be 84, or she is 84.
Mm-hmm.
And she's lives in San Antonio in a religious community.
I thought she was living in Pennsylvania for a while.
She was. And she was living in Oakland for a while, but it's now San Antonio.
Oh.
And she's terrific, and we're very close, and she comes out, you know, when I'm doing something out here for a family event, like a wedding or something like that. And then Florence is probably one of the busiest people in the world.
Good heavens, the woman never tires.
No, and she looks great. And then
yes.
the only kid I don't see is Eve, because they say she is distance herself from the show, and I really don't have any problem with that.
Well, if you called her, say, tonight, would she answer the phone, and if she knew it was you, would she hang up on you?
No, she would not hang up on me. She would, if I told her it was a personal matter, but if it has to do with the show, she really doesn't like to talk about the show, and unless you pay her a lot of money.
Right. Well, I can't blame her. I don't know. She always seems like such a nice person whenever time I see her on TV.
She's a very nice person. The problem is that neither you nor I have ever had to live the life these children have lived, which is people recognize them, and everybody comes up and talks to them regarding something they did a long time ago.
Right.
And in your own life, you want to move on. And she wants to do other things, and a lot of them, Barry embraces it more than the others, and they've all had very varying degrees of success. But can you imagine if you're Maureen and you're walking down the street and everybody comes up and goes, Marsha, Marsha, Marsha? It's got to get old.
Right.
And I don't fault them at all. A lot of people say, what's the matter with them? Why don't they just go, you know, or like Eve, why don't you just go along with it? I said, I don't criticize that. It's just because I've never had to do it.
Right. Now, I noticed she did do the Trivial Pursuit with Christopher Knight, which I was fascinating to watch that whole week.
She likes game shows. She also got them all on Weakest Link once.
Yes.
On Family Feud. She's the one who puts them all out there, let's go do it, because that's what she enjoys. And again, hey, that's fine. But I mean, personally, when somebody calls up or we're doing a reunion something and they say, please call up and ask her to do it, I just do it the simplest way. I call up, I say, here's the offer, take it or don't take it. I'm not going to convince you to do anything, because I don't have that relationship with them where I would try that.
Was the book as much fun to write as it was to write for the show?
Yeah, I'll tell you why it was fun to write, because it came about, Dad had written a book on Gilligan's Island, and he always felt that there was something missing, because these are his two most, you know, famous pieces of entertainment. And he came to me about a year and a half ago. He said, let's do a book about the Brady Bunch. And I love it because these kind of things energize him. And one of the reasons he's had this, he's very sharp and he continues to be alive, is that he has things like this to look forward to or occupy his life. And I'm only too happy to help that. So it was great fun, because as I'm doing this, I keep thinking that this is going to be fun for him to get out there and talk about it. And he doesn't do many of the kind of interviews we're doing now, because I try to guard his energies.
Right.
But he's done a couple, you know, for like a good friend of his, Connie Martinson, her husband, directed a lot of Brady, so we did that one. You know, I just have to be selective about this.
Are his memories of the Brady Bunch still as clear today as they were back then?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. But I don't think they ever were. He's always dependent on me. He's one of those people that when you're walking with him, he says, who's that guy coming up? Give me his name quick. You know, and so it's always up to me to do that. But that's okay. I mean, he is, like, look, when we talk, he says, you know, I don't have the energy I did. I said, Dad, you're great for 93. You're not so good for 40. That's all.
Now, how many total shows did you guys were you guys involved with? Do you know what the number is?
You mean other than just the Brady show?
Brady and Gilligan's Island. I mean, you wrote for or other shows that he wrote for, and you were involved with a lot of shows, too.
I've written, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of hours of different shows and movies and theater. In fact, I'm doing a play. I'm opening next week in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I've done 32 plays and all kinds of movies and television shows and many more than that haven't been done that I've just written, you know, like books and things. I just write when I'm not doing anything else, and then this material adds up.
One of the things that shocked me the most was at the end of season 5 about Robert Reed. I had no idea, first of all, that he wasn't in the last episode, and that that was the end of the show. I had no idea that he wasn't going to be brought back for the next season.
That's something in the book that no one knew about. But
how do you keep something like that a secret?
Because it was our job. it's funny, after Brady Bunch, I became an executive at ABC. And when the Brady Bunch was on, I was the youngest producer in television.
Right.
And I wanted to see how other producers did it. And so they offered me a job at ABC where I would have a chance to work with a lot of other producers. And I was not a person who just thought my dad was the best. I was pretty objective. And I found out by meeting, and I'm not going to name them, but I worked with every important producer in the business, and I found out that my dad was the best on how he treated people and how he did a show and what he thought was important and all of those things. And I think that's what you see in his show. There's a mark of someone who cares so much, and it's not about just doing episodes. It's about caring about the people in the show, people behind the camera, all those kinds of things, which enabled us to be the only father-son producing team in the business because he had respect for me and I had respect for him. So when that came up, Robert had been always very difficult. Dad appreciated him much more than I did because he was brutal in what he said about people.
Right.
It was our job to do the show and not air our dirty laundry. But one of the reasons we're writing the book now is to say what the truth is, because so much had come out about the problems we had, but it didn't come from us.
Well, thank God you finally did. It's nice to get a refreshing, true, behind-the-scenes look at this show. And that's something we don't have to worry about. Is this true? Are they making this up? Are they embellishing this? Or, you know, what really happened between Florence Henderson and Barry Williams? And, you know, what happened? Even people were saying things about the doghouse, that things were happening in the doghouse out back. And I don't know where they got all this stuff from.
There was something happened. I think that's where Mike and Susan, Bobby and Cindy, got married. I mean, in a kid kind of way. They just had this little marriage ceremony. Apparently Maureen did it.
Oh, really? That really happened?
Yeah. I mean, there were seven. You're 7 years old. They weren't doing anything. But they were the kids were just close, and we just did fun things like that.
Is Maureen McCormick good now? I saw something on one of those tabloid shows saying that she was having all kinds of problems. Is she doing okay?
She's had a lot of problems. She wrote a book about it. Some of that I knew. Some of it I didn't know. It was a lot of it more serious.
Right. Were you shocked when you read it?
Well, there's a chapter in our book about after they worked with us on the Brady Bunch, they were out of our lives in a lot of ways. I mean, they go ahead and we move off, and even though we were friendly, and I didn't know she was starting to live in the fast lane a bit. And so after we decided, when we came back to do a reunion movie, which functioned like a reunion movie, and in any family reunion, sometimes family comes back having lived in a way that maybe other people didn't know about, and she had a pretty serious coke problem. I'm not saying anything that she hasn't said in her own book, by the way.
Right, absolutely. That's another thing. There's no intent here to hurt anybody, and it's very apparent when you read the book. You'll know what I mean. All you want to do is tell them what really happened, it seems like we said before, none of the kids seemed like they were a problem to work with. Did any of them seem stressed out in the 5 years? From the fame and
no, what? Not when I was working with him. There was one thing that happened, is that it was something I was unaware of. You see, your children are only allowed to work a certain number of hours on a set.
Right.
And I diligently lived up to every single rule. Never, I mean, you're supposed to be done at 6:30, and sometimes the studio would say, "Hey, go take the welfare worker off," and buy her a drink and get rid of her so we can film more. And I never did any of those things. And we were never over. We were over half of one day in the whole 5 years of the show. What I was unaware of was that they were starting to be a musical act. So after they would leave me, they would go and start rehearsing and dancing, singing. And I didn't even know what was going on because they were out of my purview. And so maybe they were stressed out through that, especially Chris, because he hated singing and dancing. But I didn't know about that for a long time.
Hmm. And now, of course, Cindy is Susan Olsen, so I think she's going to be on The Young and the Restless now. So she's turning it.
Yeah.
It's going to be a soap opera actress.
Yeah.
She seems like a really sweet person. They all seem very nice. I mean,
they're very nice. They're very nice. And I'm close with them. We see each other in different ways. And it's like Chris became a reality show star because
right.
I was doing a reality show, and the producer said to me, I want to put one of the Bradys on. Who should I put on? And I knew enough about them and their lives that Chris would be the best one for that. And they put him on this show, and they put on a hot girl model on the show who was supposed to go for some hot guy model, and she went for Chris instead, and they've been married now for a long time.
Now, when the show first started, I don't know if you can tell me this or not. It's not in the book. I'm wondering what kind of a budget that show, the first show, would have had.
Well, when I was, I became an associate producer in the second year, and that's when I was first looking at budgets.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I think it was $84,000.
Wow, and that's nothing compared to today. I mean, what they spend on, I don't know how they have the money to spend what they spend on TV shows today. I mean, there's so many of them.
Well, they wouldn't put that up. They wouldn't put the money and spend it unless they were making money on them. I know that. I worked at another company that did shows for like, I worked at another show, and the budget was $250,000. I will not give the name of the show.
Right.
It was a cable thing. And the budget was $250,000, and this guy that I was working with, he was putting up $125,000, and the company was putting up $125,000. What the company didn't know is we were doing them for $84,000. And so the guy I was working with pocketing the other and then pocketing the other.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Well, what goes on behind the scenes that we would never find out about?
Well, you can do, especially with cameras the way they are now and the internet, you can do it easily, unless you're, you know, going crazy and spending, you know, like what they spent Charlie Sheen on an episode or something. You can do a good half-hour show for the same money we were doing Brady one in those days.
Right.
But over the overhead of the studio and the packaging fees for the agencies and all that, that's what blows the budget crazy.
Well, the whole thing with Robert Reed, and that he was in contract with ABC, and they wanted to use him rather than him not work at all, and they wanted to use him to be useful. So the money they were spending on him was worth it. I find that fascinating. Because I doubt, from the way it turned out with him, would he have done the show if that hadn't been the case?
My guess, first of all, we even talked to the producers of The Defenders, and he was a problem like them on The Defenders, so it wasn't just our show. He was just a very troubled guy who I don't think was happy. I heard talk to people who did plays with him, and he wasn't happy then. He just was never comfortable wherever he was, mostly not comfortable with himself. And he was working, and he got a nice salary, and that he appreciated that. All the difficulties we had with him, I mean, I always wanted to shake him and say, hey, look, Mike Brady is a nice guy. Everybody likes Mike Brady. Why don't you just be like him?
Now, didn't Bobby, in the later show, The Bradys, didn't he become disabled in some way?
Yeah, when we did the hour version of Brady. Yeah, he wanted to be a race car driver.
Right.
And in some race, he got creamed and was in a wheelchair. And if that show had lasted, we would have been dealing with all of those kinds of problems.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't really take off like, of course, the original Brady Bunch did. But
there's a book, there's a lot of, you'll get behind the scenes and see the reasons for all that.
Yeah, it's amazing. How high in the ratings did the Brady Bunch ever get? What was the highest it ever achieved?
Number 12.
Number 12.
The original series, yeah.
But the staying power of it is just amazing. I mean, it's still shown. Has it been shown since the day it was canceled?
Yeah, it's on somewhere. And then it goes and it gets kind of rejuvenated sometimes. You know, so it'll go on TV Land, or they'll put on marathons of it, you know. So even when it's not on a regular basis, there'll be, you know, it's on. I don't know.
I have to ask you a question about Gilligan's Island, just an aside for a second, because this is something that's been bothering me for a long time. Okay. I saw an episode, I was reading TV Guide one time, and this is going to sound weird, but it described an episode of Gilligan's Island where they play a golf tournament for $1 million, but I never saw the episode. Does that episode actually exist?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't work on the original series. And
I didn't.
The episodes, and I know most of the episodes. That one doesn't sound familiar.
I remember seeing it, and yet I never saw the episode itself. I think it was Gilligan and Mr. Howe play for $1 million.
I think that part sounds familiar. If it was like part of an episode, that sounds familiar.
And yet, I used to watch the show just to see if I could find that episode. I never saw. That's why I was.
Now I'll tell you something about Gilligan. This is something I learned much later in life, is because I knew it was a series and I knew my dad was doing it, and every week they did episodes. I didn't know a lot of kids were watching because they didn't want to miss the episode when they were rescued. So I know that there wouldn't be an episode like that.
That was frustrating, I must admit, knowing that they would never get rescued. You really kept thinking they would at some point.
Well, they did. We did a two-hour movie where they got rescued.
Oh, I mean, well, on the show, yeah, but later on, yeah.
Well, there's something on Gilligan. There was going to be, it was only on 3 years, about 99 episodes.
Right.
But it was going to be a fourth year. And they had scripts written and everything was set to go. And then the wife of the president of CBS, Mr. Paley's wife, she looked at the schedule and she said, "Where's Gunsmoke?" And she loved Westerns. And all the executives quickly erased Gilligan's Island, put Gunsmoke back, and Gilligan's Island was history at that. That's what happened.
That's it? Wow, that's a little thing like that, and there goes your show. That must have been.
And all those people have been told they were picked up and bought houses and all that, and then boom, they were out.
Wow, that's got to be. And apparently, I mean, everything I read about is when your show's off the air, they take away your parking space and everything at the studios.
I've done a lot of shows, and I've left shows and all that stuff, and it is as cold as it can be. I always just put my key on the desk and I'm gone. I don't decorate offices. I don't do any of that because you're temporary, and your shows last.
You're very honest about that. You seem to be very, you know the way the business is. And how many years have you worked in this business?
Since 1965.
Since 65, so you've been at it 45 years.
Yeah.
And you never get tired of it.
No.
And are you working on a show right now, even as?
Yeah. Well, the Gilligan movie's coming up.
Right.
I have a play opening, as they say, next week in Lincoln, Nebraska. And then I'm working on a very derivative of Brady, but it's a blended family, Latino, and my son gets mad when I say Anglo, but I can't figure out if I'm supposed to say white or Caucasian or Anglo or what, but it's Latino and white. And it's from working with George Lopez Company. So I expect this to be on the air. I would be very surprised if it doesn't sell, and then we'll be back and doing a series again.
I'm curious, anybody in the Gilligan's Island movie that we would know?
It hasn't been cast yet.
Ah.
And I'm talking to Warner Brothers about it, and what I would like to do is have a major contest and have people see if guess who they think would be the seven castaways, because it's going to be major stars for all the parts. And whoever, so I brought this up to Warner Brothers. Not only did they think it was a good idea, they also asked if they could enter the contest.
Oh, really? How interesting.
They were kidding.
And that's another thing, reading this book, Brady, I realize that you're just full of ideas. You always have really, and they always seem to work out. They always seem to be great ideas. You have this endless supply of great ideas.
Well, I'll be modest about that. But one thing that I've been taught by my dad is that any idea you come up with, it has to be not just let's be unique to be unique. What is the, does this work for the show itself? And
right.
Then if it's unique, that's a bonus. So whereas it's talked about in the book, where I say let's let the kids sing the song because the show is about the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think had been done before, but that idea is because it was right for the show.
You're very savvy like that. I mean, you're very, very good with that. And just from reading the book, you can tell that. You seem to know, when you were casting all these kids, you seem to know exactly which one would be perfect for the part.
No, I don't know. Dad, I joined the show after they'd already been cast.
Oh, okay. You didn't have anything to do with the casting. He did.
Yeah.
But he seemed to know who would be the best person.
You know, it's funny because I've worked with him a lot, and we've talked about that, and I've never have asked him, how did you know? About each of them. How did you know? I know why he picked Barry, because Barry had a maturity about himself and he wanted a child who would be like the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I know he fell in love with Susan immediately because she was just, she was the essence of cute.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
In terms of, and Maureen was a beautiful girl. Miss Maureen had won baby Miss San Fernando Valley when she was like one. And if you take, you see that picture, it's that same face just sitting in a little baby's body.
Right.
She hasn't changed at all.
She's a beautiful woman, too, now.
Yeah, she is. She is. And Chris has a twinkle about him, a little. And I identify most with Chris because I'm a middle son.
Yeah, he's got that mischievous grin on his face a lot of times.
He still has it. And Mike, I don't know why he picked Mike exactly, and I don't know why he picked Eve exactly.
But, I mean, Alice, I mean, good heavens. Without Alice, can you imagine the show without Alice?
Well,
I can't.
No. You know, but you know, it's the same as you look at any movie or TV show. It's hard to imagine other people in it. Mickey Rooney was supposed to be Archie Bunker. You know, look how different that would have been.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
Tom Selleck was supposed to be Indiana Jones. So, hey, you know, these are that's the way these things go. I was crazy about because of when she was Schulze in the Bob Cummings show, and when I weighed in as a kid. I'm not saying I had any deciding vote on all that, but when as soon as her name came up, I said, please, please get her.
Right.
By the way, it was the same with Bob Denver and Gilligan, because I was a big fan of him as Maynard in Dobie Gillis.
Nobody else could have played Gilligan like that. Nobody. I mean,
well, he wasn't the first choice. The first choice was Jerry Van Dyke.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that would have been interesting, too. Jerry Van Dyke's got a lot of talent, too, but I think, well, you look back and you can't imagine anybody but Bob Denver now.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But it was interesting, because Dad's agent at the time, when he created Gilligan's Island, was Jerry Van Dyke's agent, and Dad's agent had no faith in Gilligan's Island at all, and he advised Jerry Van Dyke not to take it and to take my mother the car instead.
Oh, no. And that didn't last all that long, I don't think.
No,
And what an outrageous title for a TV show.
Yeah.
What were you watching besides Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island at that time? What were your favorite shows back then?
I didn't have any because I was in high school and college, and that's the age, especially college, and that was the age when you don't watch television. I watched a lot when I was a kid. My favorite shows were Twilight Zone. I loved Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah.
I said Leave It to Beaver when I was at that age. I don't know.
Oh, one other thing I wanted to say about Robert Reed, every time he was a villain on a TV show, he was so good at it. I mean, I used to watch. I remember seeing him in Vegas and all those. He was doing a lot of the. I forget who. Aaron Spelling, and he would do a lot of those shows. I mean, he was always a villain. He was always so nasty as a villain.
Well, maybe that's the side of him that I used to see on the set. Maybe the.
That's true. Maybe it was. And he taught Shakespeare, as you mentioned in the book.
Right. Right.
For how long did he do that?
Well, I don't know, because he may have been doing it very well when we weren't working with him. And I knew he'd been doing it, and then how it affected us was when we were starting to do the Brady's TV series.
Right.
And it was his first scene he was supposed to be in, and instead of him being there, we got a call, the second assistant director said, oh, he's not going to be here, and he reports that he can only work in the afternoons. And he had never told us that, because he was teaching class in the morning. And so we had to revise the entire schedule, and he hadn't bothered telling anybody.
That's amazing.
Yeah, no, he was full of those kinds of things.
Yeah, I hate to say it. Well, Nate, it's interesting to read about him in the book. Anytime he crops up in the book, you know it's going to be something interesting. I mean, there was never a dull moment with him, I'm sure.
No, you know, there was one episode that it was one of my most favorite moments, most dramatic. And when I looked at the book and it's horrible for me to read the book because there's things I want to include in there.
Right.
And I forgot to put this story in. And it was, we were filming and he came in drunk. And it was a scene with him and Florence, and the director needed to get the day's work done, and I saw that he was drunk, and I didn't want that on film. And I was 24 years old, And I knew that the director would print the last take, and he would be drunk, and I couldn't have that.
Huh.
And I didn't know what to do, and there was nowhere I could turn. And so during the middle of the scene, and it was getting down to 6 o'clock, and then we'd go into overtime, and I didn't want to do that. So I took a scrim, which was the little screen that goes in front of the lights, and I threw it up into the catwalk, where it clattered around and made a lot of noise, which broke the scene. And then I went, oh, no, that's a wrap. And everybody left, because I couldn't let the thing be printed.
So we wouldn't notice it if we watched that episode at all.
No, because then they came back and filmed it a different day when he wasn't drunk. But everybody was mad at me, but I just couldn't let it happen. I could not protect Miss. I had to protect the show and Mike Brady rather than Robert Reed.
Well, you can put that in the next book. I can't wait to read. I mean, let's face it. We reading this book, you want to read about the Brady Bunch. You want to hear all the stuff behind the scenes. It's fun. I mean, it's fun to hear the day to day stuff and what really happened and who got along with who didn't get along with who. And I love the part about Marsha hitting Marsha's nose and the oh my nose thing. There are so many classic moments. You really changed society, I mean, with this show. I mean, there was so much that was on this show that's remembered very fondly for a long time. It really, I don't know, it changed the face of television in a lot of ways, don't you think?
I'm hearing you say that, and people have said that to me, and people, you can't believe what they say to my dad as soon as they find out who he is, because his name was very memorable. If he gives his credit card, Sherwood Schwartz or something, they most people come up and say, I owe you my childhood. And then people come up and they always call him an icon. And then by fallout, I'm now called the legend. And not around my house, however, but, you know. But it's something to live with that and to know also. Every producer who does any show believes that the audience knows all their episodes. They're vain enough to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to come to grips finally that people do know all the Brady episodes.
And my brother could actually watch an episode, and when he saw the credits in the beginning, he knew what show it was. I don't know how he did it, but he always would.
You know who's like that? Michelle Obama is like that.
Really?
She's been quoted as saying that. And when Barack Obama was running for president, he'd introduce his wife as a woman who was all the Brady episodes.
Well, this was, I mean, let's face it, to in our eyes, watching this show, this was like the perfect family. They all got along at the end. Everybody was happy at the end. There was a lot of happiness. They seemed to have a good time most times. I mean, yeah, there were problems. There are problems in any family. But there was this wonderfulness about the family that maybe we all wanted to be that way. I know I did.
I think you're right. And it used to take a lot of criticism. We say, that's not the way families are. And then I never had to respond to that criticism because somebody else would say, yeah, but what's so wrong with that? Why shouldn't it put something out there for people to aspire to? And I think it was fine. My family, my personal family, I had dad and mom, mom and I. I had two brothers and a sister. We didn't have a blended family. But the parenting you see in that Brady series is exactly how we were parented.
Huh.
And so when people say to me, that's not how families are, and I go, maybe that's not how your family is.
So who had a doll named Kitty Carryall? That's my question.
My sister, who played in some of the episodes, is Greg's girlfriend. I don't know if she had a doll like that because I'm 10 years older and I was kind of already in college at the time.
Where did the name come from?
Don't know.
Huh.
It's worth a lot. If you have one of those original ones now, apparently they're worth a lot of money.
Really? It's just such an unusual name. I figured it was somebody, because a lot of times in the book, and this is interesting, but some of the names in the TV series were actual names of people that you knew. Or
Yeah.
I mean,
but but Kitty Carryall, I do know this. That the doll itself has like pockets, and it would put things in it, so it was Kitty Carryall, like she would carry things around. So that's where that name came from.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's funny I didn't think of that.
Well, I don't think we ever had a close-up of the doll, because you would just kind of carry it around. The names, this is something that people, a lot of people do. When they do a TV series, and and Brady, we were guilty of that as well. Sometimes your friends would get a kick, they tune in. So, I mean, I know on Family Matters, there's a real Steve Urkel, and the producers named a character after him.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to live with that.
I think the episode that stands out in my mind is one of my favorite episodes. It's probably because it made me so emotional watching it, and still does when I watch it today, is the one where Marcia nominates him for Father of the Year, her father.
That's my dad's favorite. It's interesting, because that is a very touching thing. There's a couple of themes in there where you know, she was trying to do something good, and she couldn't even tell him that she was doing something good, and she was being punished at the same time. You know, there was something that happened, and as I said, I was like kind of like a camp counselor for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Something really bad happened one day. I was driving to go to a meeting. I left the set to go to a meeting, and I was going down Highland in Los Angeles, and the speed limit was, let's say, 35 or something. I was going 25, and there was a big dog in front of me, and so I swerved to avoid hitting the dog, and I hit a little dog that was next to it. But I hadn't seen the little dog because it was behind the big dog.
Oh.
And I pulled over, and I picked up the little dog, and it died while I was holding it. Now, this was before cell phones and all, so I didn't know what to do. And I laid the dog down on the ground right next, you know, right, I took it off the street and laid it down. And then I drove to my meeting, which where I could get to a phone, and I had written down the name of the people with on the dog tag and the animal, you know, regulation or something.
Wow.
And I called there. And this was very bad, and I felt really bad about it, but I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. And then I came back, and we spent a lot of time, you know, with the kids, and I was a surrogate father in some ways, because I was on the set all the time. And I told the kids this, and it was a terrific lesson for them, and it's a lesson for everybody, because sometimes when you do as much as you can, something bad may happen, but you didn't do anything wrong. You can feel bad about it, but you can't, you know, blame yourself.
Right.
And it was a real important lesson, and I think that's even in that, you know, Father of the Year kind of thing. And each of the Brady's episodes did have, you know, lessons and themes and things. And Paramount even cut episodes down to 7 minutes for Oxford Films, which is a division of theirs.
Right.
Go to schools as educational films.
I still see the look on his face when she finally tells him at the end.
Yeah.
And he realizes that all this time that's what she was doing, and he was treating her so lousy. I mean, I'll never forget that look on his face. It's just one of those episodes that really works on a lot of different levels.
Right. And just because you're walking lockstep with my dad on that, because that's the one he always talks about.
Was it hard to come up with ideas for the different shows? Did you know when you came up with an idea, you and your dad? I'm embarrassed. I keep forgetting your dad was more. We did a lot of the writing, too. I mean, you both
did. He did most of it.
Most of it.
On the set, but toward the last year or two, I would participate in all the writing sessions, too.
But did you know what would work and what wouldn't as soon as you thought of it?
Sure. But I'll tell you one thing. It's different now, and it's affecting even what I'm doing today. In those days, when we came up with an idea, we would talk whether we'd have seen anything like it on another show, and we would not do it if there was a plot line that we had seen like that. It's very different today. You do get a group together and you say, hey, let's do the Brady Bunch episode. I've heard this. The Brady Bunch episode about this, but we'll just switch it to this. And we never wrote that way. We always said, an episode would be like something you've seen before, but it was nothing we ever did consciously. Now they do it consciously.
That's interesting. What was the episode? Now, I don't remember the whole episode, but there was an episode where there were two Peters.
Yes, and we did one where there was Ann B. Davis also had when she did Sergeant Emma.
Oh, right, that's great.
Yeah, there was a kid, and I love it. I'll tell you this, I love it when somebody will say to me, who was the actress that played the sergeant, you know, and I go, oh, that's so good that they didn't recognize it was Ann B. playing two parts.
Sort of like what they did with Elizabeth Montgomery on Bewitched.
Right.
They put another name in the credits, and everybody got confused. They thought it was really another actress.
Well, good. Should, you know, I think you should do that.
But what was the premise of that episode with Peter, where there were two Peters? I can't remember the whole...
There was a kid who came to the school, and he saw him walking down, and he realized they looked a lot alike, and they kind of decided to have to goof around with that, and they would take each other's places and stuff, you know.
It's funny, it's one of those episodes that I don't think I've seen a lot in syndication for some reason, but I do remember the episode. I do.
Yeah.
And that's the wonderful thing about the Brady Bunch is in your mind you know just about every one, and you think of another one and another one, like the one with Marion Ross and the measles, and everybody said, well, you can't get the measles that quickly. Nobody, you know, they don't spread that quick. You know?
Maybe that's why the AMA was upset. Remember I told you that's why they were upset. Maybe that was the reason.
But it was, but you know what? It still worked, and it was amusing, and that's all that really. Now, wasn't Herbert Anderson in that episode too?
Yes, they were both the doctors there.
Now he played Dennis Menace's father, right?
Right.
On Dennis the Menace. See, I knew some of this stuff anyway.
Right. Oh, we had one episode. We had Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. He was in it. in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
We had Jay Silverhill.
Right.
Who was Tonto. He played a grandfather in that show.
I remember when I first saw in the Grand Canyon episode where they see the tarantula, and that freaked me out when I was a kid.
That's a Hawaii episode.
Oh, that was Hawaii. You're right.
Tarantula was Hawaii.
You're right.
Hey, who are you talking to? Because I'm right.
I know, I'm sorry. For some reason, I was thinking it was Grand Canyon. But anyway, I just remember when I first saw that episode, that it freaked me out. I'm thinking, oh, that's a real tarantula.
What was interesting with that one is that in some of the shots, it was a tarantula, but a dead one. And then some of them, when it was crawling, it was a live one, and it was crawling on him. And they had a little thing. This guy was a really creepy guy who had these spiders, and he put these little things, these little balls, over the fangs of the tarantula. And I kept thinking to myself, who makes these little balls? And he said, there can't be a big market for those things.
What do you think would have been the focus of the sixth season had there been one? Did you have a lot of plans for episodes?
In the sixth season?
Yeah, if there had been one.
I don't think we had anything lined up. What I wanted to do, and I was starting to make some noise about, I would have loved the Bradys to get out on the road and have Mike Brady, even if it was Robert Reed or a different actor, to be, as he was an architect, to be hired by the government to go to famous places around where there are monuments and things to build something. So the Bradys would get involved with different truly American kind of things. That's what I thought, because it would have been, again, you remember we were talking before about when you were claiming that I was very innovative and all?
Right.
No, looking at what was right for the show, I said, there's nothing more American than this Brady family, and let's tie him in with America and be a first show to be out on the road like that.
I think that would have been interesting. It interests me just to hear you say it. But I always wonder, I sometimes wonder that about that in my favorite shows. What if they had gone out there? What would have they been like?
Well, I don't know. I know at one point they wanted Mike and Carol to have a child, themselves, a natural child, rather than call his cousin Oliver or somebody moving in. But I don't remember. I know there was a script written like that, but I don't know what happened to it.
Right. Now, Eve Plum, either her father or mother is famous for something, aren't they?
Eve Plum's father was in music. And I know he produced albums and things, and I think he produced the record of Romeo and Juliet, you know.
Okay.
But he did a lot of music.
Was her mother famous at all?
No, her sister was an actress. Her mother's name was Flora Plum, and her sister is also Flora Plum. And I don't know, her mother, I don't think, was famous. No.
I heard something about her parents, I thought, and maybe it's the music.
Yeah, she was very involved in music and very talented. Neely. His name was Neely Plum.
Is there any? It's interesting to watch the pilot of the Brady Bunch today. It's so different in a lot of ways from the regular show. I mean, in my mind, it just seemed like, I don't know how long was the pilot when it aired.
The same length. It was a 22-minute show.
It was still a 22-minute show.
Yeah.
Was the pilot harder to film than the other shows?
Well, okay. Remember, I didn't work on it, but I will tell you everything I know about it.
Right.
First, we were not on the location yet. We were not in the Brady house.
Right.
So we had two different houses that they came from. And then it was filmed at somebody else's house for the backyard for the wedding. So there was many more locations than we did. Normally in Brady Bunch, it was just in the house with occasionally another location.
And is that house still standing, the Brady Bunch house right now?
Yeah. Now, it's funny because my son lives on the same street down the block, and it drives him crazy.
But
that house was a one-story house, and we hung a window on the outside to make it look like a two-story house.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting how you can do that and make people believe it, really?
It is not our business. It's not what things are. It's what they look like.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like I wrote in the book where there's a lot of kidding about the backyard with being plastic and grass and that. And one day, one of the big lights fell over, which was very hot, and it melted some of the grass. And so, it was cheaper for them just to sprinkle some leaves in there than lay down new grass. And that's what they do all the time.
I don't know if I asked you this, but are any of the kids based on anybody's kids? I mean, are there any similarities between the Brady Bunch kids and anybody you knew at all?
No.
Nothing?
No.
Would anybody ever come in and say, well, I had something really funny happen and suggest it as an idea?
No, nothing ever came from the kids that way. We got the personalities of the kids from who they really were. But things would come up. This is kind of a funny story. When we were doing the volcano episode, which is one of my favorites.
Right.
Okay. Well, I had a fascination with the macabre. I love natural disasters and volcanoes and earthquakes.
Yeah, where does that come from? That's kind of interesting.
I don't think I was that different than many kids, but...
Yeah. You know. No, I don't think
anyway,
so either.
Anyway, I remember for science class, I built this dumb volcano and all. So now we're sitting around trying to have the subplot for the episode where Marcia joined a club, and what are we going to do to have interest elsewhere? That's how shows are basically a plot and a subplot, and they come together. I mean, the best ones like that is Seinfeld always, a plot and a subplot, and they come together very strange.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but ours come together. So I'm sitting there, I can't think of anything, and I pride myself in being, you know, coming up with ideas quickly, and I'm fuming up there, and Dad says, what's the matter? I said, I feel like I'm going to explode. And he says, what do you mean explode? And then it all just came to me. Well, Peter's building a volcano. That's how that happened.
That's one of the coolest parts of the book. We get to see the thought processes behind these episodes. I really find that fascinating, where these ideas came from. I mean, because you come up with it. It's coming up with the idea is great, but how long would it take you to write an episode once you came up with the idea?
Now, I didn't write episodes of The Brady Show.
Right.
Directed some and produced them.
Oops.
I've written episodes of many, many other series.
Right.
I am an anomaly, and no one who is listening to us here should take me as an example.
Right.
It takes me maybe a day to write a half-hour episode.
Really?
But nobody else writes like that. One of the reasons is I don't think I'm a brilliant writer. I think I'm a really good writer. Therefore, I'm not one of those people who dies trying to find the perfect word. I find a really good word and move on. And some people think it's perfect, and some people don't. But I just, and also I let my characters do all the writing for me. And some famous writer once, and I think it was Ring Lardner Jr., he said, why write a movie when you can just watch it in your typewriter? So I just let my characters do all the writing, and then I'm amazed at what they do. So I put them in a room. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of writers, Neil Simon, about this, and that's the way he works. Because your characters should take you. You know this has to happen in a scene. Well, let them do it for you. Let them do it.
Right.
It's
interesting. I mean, just listening to you about the writing process. One of the reasons I do all these interviews. I just love to talk about the writing process and get into the...
For everybody.
Yeah.
It's really different for everybody. And I know people that need every single thing in an outline. And to me, that would just be handcuffing. So I don't do that. But I'm not advising people do it my way. I just know that everybody has to do it his or her own way.
Just one or two more questions, and then we'll have to call it. This has been so much fun. I could talk all night about it. But I'm wondering, the day after you found out the show was canceled, what was that like for you? What was it like for your father?
Okay, now this is a long time ago. I know what it was like for me. I don't know what it was like for him, because this was the first show that I had really worked on myself, and it was 5 years of it.
Right.
And I had gone to school. I had gone to junior high and high school and college, and everything was supposed to be in those kind of large increments of time. So suddenly I was working for 5 years, and I believed that I would now work on another show that would also go 5 years. And I went to the studio after I cleaned out my office, knocked on the door, had a meeting, and I said, okay, what's next? And they said, The Door. So I was the youngest producer in television, and I was the youngest ex-producer in television. And I was very lost without having something to get up to go to.
And I imagine,
I started to become very interested in the Dodgers, because they gave a regularity to my life. So I listened in those days, just listening on the radio, to the Dodger games, and in the morning I'd read the paper and see if I got the box score right. And I needed that kind of thing to make my life regular. And then immediately, I can't say immediately, so that was, show went off in 74, 75, I did a movie, I raised the money and made a movie, it got distributed, and then we did, so maybe there wasn't huge gaps. I've had huge gaps in my career since then, and I do know that I must always get up like I'm going to work and go write and find another part of the day is to service the writing and talk to a studio and something and then have a family and recreation, you know, and it's just like going to work, and maybe I'm not paid for it for a long time.
But you didn't get depressed, right? You seem very confident, and that's good. I mean, you seem to just, you're willing, you're a hard worker. I mean, obviously, the time you spent in all this, and what came out of it, I mean, a show that nobody's ever going to forget. It's going to be in, it'll be in my mind probably till the day I die in some way. I mean.
Well, you know, that's very comforting. I mean, to know that it has had a lasting effect, and I get a lot of people tell me that, and I'm very proud of that. It's not for me. It's much more for Dad, because I have other things that I'm doing, and I love the fact that I can do Brady Bunch and did it with Dad, and we did it together. And these are the things that he will be remembered for, and his name is linked to those. And I would prefer other things.
Right. So I love the music, too. I mean, I can hear the music in my head, too. That was great, the way they did the music.
Yeah. It was, Dad and Frank Duvall, and Dad wrote the theme song. We still fight about it, because this line about what much more than a hunch...
Right.
What the hell does that mean? So he said, hey, I needed a rhyme for Bunch. And I said, but you can't just put in because you need a rhyme. And he says, well, listen, when you write a song that's popular, you tell me about it.
But the music is a standout, too. I mean, because they always had this interesting music for something when something was interesting happening on the show. And
very much. And also, he loved the Brady theme itself because it could be played upbeat and it could be played sentimental. In a lot of different pieces of it, and that's one of the. I think that's very well done in the show.
How can anybody express how grateful we are to you for what you did? I mean, for bringing this show to television, for bringing such hours of enjoyment and laughter. I mean, when you can laugh at a show for as long as we've been able to laugh at the Brady Bunch, how amazing is that? That you've influenced that many people, millions and millions and millions of people. I mean, that's got to be a great feeling.
You know what? I got to tell you right now. As we're talking like this, this is crazy. I feel like I really want to go watch an episode because you're making me think that way.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I don't have any episodes on DVD, or I can go watch it.
Around. I don't know. I'll look for one. But I think maybe because, it gets me sentimental for the show.
I think that's another point, too, because when you watch a show, you're instantly transported back to when you watched it before. And I find that with a lot of shows. Now, the thing with shows is I can watch shows from the 70s, but a lot of them don't hold up for me. In other words, I'll watch them, and they don't have the appeal that they used to have. The Brady Bunch always seems to have this appeal. When you're instantly, once you know what episode it is, you're instantly caught up in the episode again, just like you were before. There's some kind of staying power, just like The Honeymooners was. Anytime you watch that episode of The Honeymooners, you laugh just as hard as you laughed before.
Yeah. Well, great comedy. I won't say Brady's great comedy, but I remember... I took my son to Silent Movie Theater to see Buster Keaton and watch The General or something, one of those. And I looked around, and the audience was hysterical. And the thing had been done like 100 years ago or 85 years ago. I said, isn't that amazing? And I took him to Stratford in England, and we watched Measure for Measure.
Mm.
And the audience was laughing and emotionally involved when appropriate. And I go, here's the guy who wrote this. Shakespeare wrote this 500 years ago. And human emotions are what they are. People don't change that much. One of the things in Brady, we made it non-topical, and that might be what you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Because when a show is part of its time so much that there's a, you know, topical references or catchphrases.
Marsha, Marsha, Marsha.
That's not a catch. I mean, we only did that in one episode.
It's hard to believe, you know.
It's become a catchphrase. But that's fascinating about it, because that was Dad's rule. He said, we want these shows to be isolated from time. And so kids always will have problems with cheating in school or jealousies and things. And those are the kind of subjects we wanted to touch on, because those are timeless.
I have to ask you one last question. What do you think of the comedy on TV today? It's certainly a lot different from when you were working on the Brady Bunch.
It's much crueler.
Do you find it as funny as it used to be?
Some. I mean, I'm a fan of Modern Family, and I'm a fan of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and actually The Middle, which I think has gotten much better.
Yeah.
But they're all edgier, and I don't know that if I had young kids, I'd want them to watch those shows. because there's a lot of things in it that you can't appreciate as a family and without having to explain to your kids a lot.
But you look at and shows like Malcolm in the Middle that sort of teach kids how to be mean and nasty.
I know. And I think
it's upsetting. Really,
I think it is upsetting, but at the same time, other places have risen up to take that over from the networks, because now we have all the cable and the Nickelodeon kind of places, and a lot of those are good. But television is very different. My next book, by the way.
Right.
I'm not plugging it because no one's even.
No, go ahead. I want you to. That's fine.
It's called Why TV Sucks. And it's in a careful analysis of why we are where we are, how it got here, so you'll understand it, because I've been in the business a long time and I've seen all these things happen, and how it can change and how it can get better.
Well, we'll have to do another interview. I can't wait to read it.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. That one's fun. This one is emotional and personal, and the other is wittier, I think. I hope so. I intended it to be.
You just seem like a, and somehow I knew this before I even called you. I knew you were going to be a nice guy. I just, you know, you come off as a really straightforward, easygoing guy. Never in this book does it seem like you have an ego or you're full of yourself or anything. And that, I find that very refreshing.
I don't know. I mean, that's hard for me to address. But I just look at a situation. I said, okay, well, I think this should be done.
Right.
And it never has to do with money. It never has to do with anything except, wouldn't this be fun, and this should be done. And so that's how I approach life. And I have a wonderful wife, and I have two great kids. And
you seem to be very appreciative of things, too. I mean, just, I don't know how I can tell all this by reading your book, but there's sort of an insight into you, too, in this book, too, which I find interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've always said you can't hide yourself from your writing.
I mean, people may go into this thinking, well, I wonder what dirt's in this book. There isn't going to be a lot of dirt in this book.
No, I don't think there's dirt. I just think I want some things in there that people didn't know before.
Right.
But I don't think it's dirt. But first of all, there wasn't that much. You know, sometimes I wish there was.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you this one, which is kind of funny. Cause
right.
Barry was 16, and we always have to get girls from him, including my sister, to be his girlfriends on the show.
Right.
But since he was 16, we didn't want to have kids who were that young, girls who were that young, because then we'd have to get another teacher and have to go to school.
Right.
So all of his girlfriends were over 18. And now I was only 22. So I was, I would go out with these girls, see?
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying I wasn't a big...
No, I know.
Thing, but I would go out with these girls. And so now my kids would watch the show when they got of that age, or watching Brady Bunch, and they'd see one of those episodes. They'd go... Boy, that was a good episode. I go, no, that was a great episode.
That's terrific. All these little stories. It's good you can laugh at yourself, too. I like that. That makes you...
Yeah. That expression, you know, something suddenly came up when a girl broke the date.
Oh, yes.
That's right out of my sad dating history.
I mean, these lines are unbelievable. I mean, we're just going to remember these lines forever. They're never... You know how you watch a TV show now? I mean, I find a lot of comedies very, very... I don't like a lot of them, the ones on today. I just can't... I can't relate to the characters. That's one of the biggest problems I have. I find that the characters are very negative, or they're just not... They're not interesting enough to me.
Well, one of the reasons, and it's evolved this way, and in that other book, which... What happens is the writing staffs get bigger and bigger.
Right.
And this started with Gary Marshall, and I love Gary, and I think he's a great guy.
But how can they afford to have so many people writing?
Because that's what happened. It evolved that way, and they have more and more writers. But you see, in order for a writer to stay on a staff, he has to get material in the show. And in order to get the material in the show, it's not going to be about story. It's going to be about lines. And the easiest lines are insult lines, and then shows start to expand in terms of thematically putting in more lines and more lines, which are just insult lines, and the characters are always angry with each other, because that's the easiest kind of comedy to write. And it evolved that way. It doesn't have to be that way, but that's what's happened.
I just want to be able to laugh more. And one of the biggest shows that I found made me laugh in the last 20, 30 years was The Golden Girls.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's something about that show. It's got comedy, it's got drama. It you care about the characters, even though they do insult each other, and they call her Rue McClanahan a tramp every 5 minutes. You know,
yeah.
It's funny. It's funny stuff, and it's.
I'll tell you, I watch Two and a Half Men.
Yeah.
I think that's very funny. I think there's more jokes per minute in that show, And it, but another thing about that show and why that's a success, and people, some of the networks don't understand these things, that has a very important core to it. I mean, the brother accepting the other brother into his house with this kid.
Right.
That's very important. The same way as Friends, if Friends separated itself from all the other shows, and it starts off with a song saying, I'll be there for you. That's very important. This is non-selfish television.
Right.
That's at the guts of it. But when you have a show on where people got, I got my problems, and they walk around with their own problems, people don't want to see that.
Right.
They want to see where people are helping each other. And that's the guts of television. And I can go to all this analysis of all of this.
Oh, I can't. We'll do that when your other book comes out. This is
okay, I'd love to.
You're just a wonderful human being. You really are. You and your dad. And I apologize for forgetting his name. I'm very embarrassed about that. But don't tell him.
My dad's name.
when I said the name of the book in the beginning, I forgot to mention his name. That was not on purpose. I promise you. You're just wonderful. Thank you so much for letting us get a peek inside the Brady Bunch. And the book again is called Brady, 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 and it is out from Running Press, available on all your bookstores. I hope you get a chance to read it because it's wonderful.
I really appreciate it. This was great fun.
Thank you so much. This has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.